You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects.
Hello, and welcome to episode 45 of Tea Break Archaeology. My name is Dr. Matilda Siebrecht, and today I am savouring a black tea, a plain black tea. And that's actually because I'm currently away from home, so I'm in a hotel room recording this, which is very exciting. So that might be why my voice sounds a little bit different, because I have a slightly different microphone setup. But yes, and so I'm just having a standard black tea provided by the hotel. So there you go, that's me, plain and simple today. And I wanted to wish everyone a very happy new year, because this is our first episode back in the year 2026. And that kind of gave me a bit the idea for this particular episode, because for me, at least, I know a lot of people do New Year's resolutions and things like that. I don't necessarily hold with resolutions. I usually don't try and do them because I usually end up just failing and then it makes me sad. But this year I thought, you know what, there are a couple of things that I would really like to do. So one of the things that I've set myself this year is to get back into crafting, because I haven't really had time to do that for the last year or two. I've been very busy with work and things like that. So I thought, right, crafting, more crafting this year. Let's get back to it. And I was thinking about that when I was thinking about this episode, because that is one of the things that I have tried to focus on a little bit more in this rebrand of the podcast that I started in September last year when I restarted the podcast. For those of you listening in for the first time, I would obviously recommend checking the back catalogue, but that might just indeed show you a little bit how the podcast has varied over time. So at the beginning, I was focusing more on Tea Break time travel and imagining we were going back in time and looking at a particular object. And I had a guest specialist who would tell us all about that object, etc., which was wonderful. And I loved that. But I wanted to focus more on the sort of approachability aspect of it and the kind of coziness of it, which I talk about in my first episode back in September of 2025. Yeah, so I was thinking more about crafting, and then I was thinking, I mean, maybe I should explain a little bit why I want to focus on crafting so much. It's not just because I love crafting, but crafting is actually pretty important and essential when it comes to archaeology, especially if, like me, you focus on material culture. So remember, material culture is the material evidence of cultures that have been left behind. So objects, artifacts, etc. Things that you can hold, basically. That's, I suppose, what material culture would be to me. And so crafting is important because if you want to understand archaeological objects, you have to understand a bit more about the craft behind them, behind those objects. How were they made? How were they interacted with? What was the purpose of their being made? And so by looking at crafts in the present and understanding materials in that way, from that practical and physical perspective, you can get a better understanding of these artifacts rather than just looking at them through a lens. And I think this is a problem a lot of the time with archaeological artifacts, because so many of the time you see them as a non-archaeologist, you'll see archaeological artifacts in a museum, right? And they're like static objects placed behind a glass case. You can't touch them. You can't interact with them, which, you know, is probably a good thing most of the time because they just break. If everyone interacted with them over time, they've been around for a couple of thousand years, you know, let's not push it. But at the same time, I think that it's a real shame because it's made archaeological materials into this sort of static thing. You don't see them as part of a crafting tradition. You see them as just a standalone object. And so I guess by trying to bring craft back into the question, by trying to bring craft back into the conversation, that's a way to really engage with the materials and the objects. So I thought, okay, how can I talk about that on the podcast today? And I thought, I know, I want to try a new sort of format where I give a little bit of an overview of methods and theories. And I started doing this last year as well with my time travel training episodes, where basically I would look at different methods. I started by looking at different dating methods. And no, I do not mean archaeologists dating either each other or non-archaeologists. I mean, how do we date? How do we identify how old something is? And so I looked at different scientific methods and approaches. And I thought, oh, it'd be fun to continue them with that theme. So yes, we're going to have, it's not time travel training, it's tea break training, but, you know, same thing. So you're going to get little short tea break sized chunks of an introduction to a particular archaeological method or theory. So Here's the first one. I'm very excited about it. And I thought, well, okay, we're focusing on crafting. Of course, I have to talk about experimental archaeology. And experimental archaeology is kind of a funny name because it's not experimental in terms of like being fringe. It's experimental in terms of it's archaeology that focuses on experiment. So I like to think of it as sort of the closest you can get to time travel, really. So it's sort of archaeology you can watch in real time. It's really practical. It's basically a method whereby researchers will replicate things or processes from the past in order to test interpretations of archaeological evidence. So the emphasis is on like scientific hypothesis-driven experimentation. So you have to include aspects such as repeatability. You have to have a strong research question. It is a scientific method. I'm trying to think of examples that people might have seen, which might be, for example, if you attend a museum and they're showing you how they would have made a particular object in the past, that is a form of experimental archaeology. Of course, there is a difference between things like reenactment, living history, and experimental archaeology. Reenactment and living history, which is, for example, what you might see if you go to medieval fairs or festivals and they might have nice knights jousting or sword fighting or something like that, people dressed up in sort of medieval or prehistoric garb, that is not experimental archaeology. That is reenactment or living history, depending on how you're doing it, whether you're doing it for a public crowd or whether you're doing it for sort of your own enjoyment. And that's more just a form of exhibition, a form of exploring the past in your own way. But in order for it to be experimental archaeology, it does have to have that scientific framework. So it does have to have a solid research question. It has to have method. It has to have repeatability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, a lot of people doing experimental archaeology are involved with reenactment and living history, because you already have all the materials, you already have sort of these things. And through creating, for example, your costume as a medieval peasant, you need to learn a lot of different techniques and different technologies. And through learning them, through replicating things, you are, in a way, involved with experimental archaeology. Anyway, that's what experimental archaeology is. It's sort of replicating things, activities, processes in order to understand how things work. So what are the origins of experimental archaeology? Well, I mean, as a concept, it's actually been around for a very long time. It's been around for longer than it has officially been defined, really, because early archaeology was already very experimental in a way. It was just not formally labeled as experimental archaeology. So, for example, there was someone called Sven who was around in the early to mid 1800s. And he was a zoologist and an archaeologist based in Sweden. He was the director at the Swedish Natural History Museum from 1828 to 1831. He was a professor of natural history at Lund University from 1832 to 1856. He was also the rector at that university. And he basically was involved with using ethnography and practical knowledge to interpret prehistoric tools. And this was something that was happening a lot in the early 1800s. This time period was just an incredible one for scientific development and understanding of how the world worked and how it had worked, how it had came to be, how we had came to be, which I always think is really, it's a wonderful time. And if you're looking at all the kind of people who are around at this time, you know, you have Charles Darwin, you have Charles Lyell, you have all these incredible people, Mary Anning. And so there's a lot going on. There's a lot of questioning of kind of previous assumptions of how we came to be and who we are as a species. So, for example, when you started to have the discovery of all these ancient tools, and for sort of a nice overview of the evolution of stone technology, do go and check out my December episode of the archaeology of stone tools, because I go into a lot of detail about how different stone technologies developed over time, from sort of the oldest to the latest ones. So go and have a look at that. But basically, as all these stone tools were coming about, one of the big questions was whether these ancient tools were just sort of naturally created this way, or whether they were tools, whether they were intentionally human made. Because if they were, that was incredible. And it was incredible in the end. So a lot of the time, people were trying to show whether these stone tools could have been made by humans and how you would have made them. Enter someone called Sir John Evans, who was around in the mid to late 1800s. And what's really fascinating is he was actually, officially, he was the manager of a family-led paper manufacturing business. So that was how he started off. But he was really fascinated by archaeology and objects. And he actually became president of the Society of Antiquities, from 1885 to 1892, and he then continued to be president of several other sort of academic societies, including the Royal Numismatic Society, so coins, the Geological Society of London, the Anthropological Institute of Great Britain and Ireland, the Society for Chemical Industry, and the British Association for the Advancement of Science. So for people listening again, don't ever let anyone tell you that, you know, if you've chosen your road, you have to stick with it. You can change from being the manager of a paper manufacturing business to being one of the most renowned 1800s flint nappers that the world has ever seen. So basically, he became interested in trying to replicate these stone tools that were being found by archaeologists all around the world. And interestingly enough, at this time, flints were still actually in active use. Like, flint was in use as a material through gun flints, which are these tiny little sort of square-shaped, usually, objects that are put in a certain place in the gun. And when you pull the trigger, it would light a spark against this gun flint, and that would then light the fuse, which would send off the shot. I will put in a little proper diagram or article or something that shows how these work, because I can't explain it properly. But basically, they were around. So there was a general understanding of flint napping in contemporary society at this time. So that provided almost a kind of ethnographic data for Sir John Evans. So he was able to look at people who were making these flints professionally. He was able to learn different techniques, and he was then able to apply them to the study of these ancient stone tools. And I mean, his work is renowned as kind of really the start of what, like, really well-structured and well-researched experimental archaeology. I mean, his flint napping capabilities really improved, and he became a really well-known and renowned flint napper in the field of archaeology at this time. So that was the mid to late 1800s. And then in the 1900s, you start to see the emergence of something called processual archaeology or new archaeology. And this came out of this idea by archaeologists. One of the big examples is Gordon Child, who's a very influential archaeologist in Scottish archaeology, especially. And Gordon Child didn't conduct experiments himself, but he was really crucial in this argument that was emerging, which is that archaeology should explain the process of things and not just typologically classify artifacts. Because up until that point, all that people had done was sort of compare different things to other things in archaeology. So be like, okay, well, this is older than this, so this came before this, and this is a different style to this, so it's a different culture to this. And that was all that people were doing. They were just putting things in boxes, putting things in typologies, and categorizing them according to that. But Gordon Child and his contemporaries were saying, no, what we want to do, we need to understand how they actually came about. So the processes of kind of how and why they came about in that way. And that led to the emergence of something called processual archaeology, which I'm going to do a whole episode on processual versus post-processual archaeology. For now, I would recommend checking out episode 13 of Am I Trowel, where my co-host Ash and I get into the details of what is processual and post-processual archaeology. It's basically a theoretical framework that is used within archaeological research. So it really focuses on the processes involved. It emphasizes something called positivism, so basically scientific and objective inquiry, hypothesis testing, etc. So some really big names include people like Lewis Binford. So you're really looking at kind of, yeah, a more objective and scientific approach to the study of the past. And this was fantastic for experimental archaeology. It opened the door for people like Don Crabtree, who was really influential, again, in lithic studies, the study of stone tools, because he also showed the importance of things like skill in stone tool replication. So it led to this idea that in order to look at the past, you have to understand how they were made, which is kind of the whole point of experimental archaeology. And that leads us very nicely into part two of this podcast, where we're going to discuss the kind of the strengths and the issues of experimental archaeology in relation to this. So I hope this gave a nice little overview. We're going to have a very quick break to top up our tea, and we will be right back. Okay, welcome back, everyone. I hope that your teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So we talked a little bit about how experimental archaeology came about, how this kind of concept of replicating things in order to better understand the archaeological record came about. So what about experimental archaeology as a method? And I do want to highlight, experimental archaeology is a method. It's an approach you can use as part of your research. But as we're going to see, it shouldn't necessarily be all and end all of that research. So some of the real strengths of archaeology is that it really, it sort of bridges that gap between the artifacts, the objects, those things that you're looking at in the museum exhibitions, in the, you know, behind that glass wall, and the actual behavior of past societies. So as processual archaeologists wanted to find out, we're looking at this process. We're looking at how things were made. We're looking at how people in the past worked and ticked. And there's all sorts of issues with this, which I'm not going to get into right now in terms of processual approaches, but I will talk about at some point in a future episode. And one of the nice things about experimental archaeology is because you're sort of directly interacting with the material, you're getting a lot more insights into things that wouldn't necessarily happen if you were in a sort of more theoretical environment, or if you were also in a way more controlled environment. So, for example, you have this thing called experiential archaeology, which there's a lot of debate, to be honest, amongst the experimental archaeology community over whether all experimental archaeology is experiential archaeology, or whether it's sort of, yeah, it should be separate things, whether one is more valid than the other. Anyway, point being, experiential archaeology focuses on this idea that, you know, as you're conducting these experiments, you're also experiencing it to yourself. So you're getting all these new insights into how the materials work, which I'm going to provide some examples from my own research in a second with that. Because of this, new questions emerge during your research that you would never have even thought about otherwise. And again, I'll give some examples in a second. So because of that, it really highlights as well what things are restricted by the practicality of the material and what things are restricted by the potential culture of the time. What do I mean by this? Well, so there's this thing within material culture studies called the chaînon, which is a very fancy wording, basically meaning the different steps involved in making something. So the operational sequence, chaîne opératoire. And it's a really essential theory concept in the field of archaeological artifact analysis, material culture studies, because it's that is what I was talking about, right? When you're looking at an object, you shouldn't just look at an object and see the finished object. What you want to look at, especially as a material culture specialist, is what was involved in the creation of that object, right? If nothing else, at the end of this episode, I want you to go to a museum and look at these objects in the glass thing and not just think, oh, it's a pretty object, but think, oh, what happened to make this object? How did they make it? And so that's how you look at the chaîne opératoire. So you're looking at things like, how did they source the materials? Were the materials locally sourced? Did they have to travel far to get them? How did they learn the skills that were involved? What kinds of tools were involved? What were the different steps that were involved? What was the significance of these different steps? And basically, when looking at the chaîne opératoire, when looking at the different steps and sequences involved, you are essentially looking at the decision-making process of people in the past. Because you're trying to work out, okay, but why was this the next step? Why did they do this? Why did they decide to do this? Was it A, because that's the only thing they could do? Because with the materials they have, that's literally the only practical thing to do. Like if, you know, hit a stone, it's going to chip. So therefore, in order to chip the stone, you hit the stone, you know? So there's certain practical restrictions based on the material. I mean, there's only so much you can do with the material. There's certain decisions that have to be made in order to work with particular materials. You know, if you're working with a softer or a harder material, of course, that's going to change the decisions that you make in how you work it. But it also could show different cultural restrictions. So maybe they were doing something a certain way because there was some sort of ritual involved with it, because there was some sort of social understanding within that particular group that, okay, this is how we have to treat this material, because maybe it's a sacred material. Maybe it comes from a particular location because that is a particular important location for some reason, either due to, yeah, ritual belief or worldview, or maybe just because of some sort of nostalgia concept. But the point is, that's what you can look at when you're looking at the chaîne opératoire, because you're looking at this decision-making process and you're basically trying to work out, okay, but why did they make this decision at this point? And one of the ways to kind of say, okay, well, maybe it was just because of the practical limitations of the material. How do I test this? I'll try and make it myself. And if the material has those limitations, then I'll know, okay, it's most likely that that's what that limitation was, and that's why they made that decision. So that's where experimental archaeology comes into its own, because it allows you to grapple with the material and answer these questions that are just not possible theoretically. Or, well, they are possible theoretically, but they will give you like 1,000,000,000 different options Whereas with experimental archaeology, you can have specific questions that you want to answer, and that's how we understand the material better. So I want to give some examples from my own research. So I'm going to go through all of my different research processes. So back in my undergrad degree at Aberdeen University, which was the first time that I ever experienced experimental archaeology, which I've realized is quite a funny way to phrase that. But the first time that I came across experimental archaeology, we had an experimental archaeology class as part of my degree, which was incredible. The first class we had, we went to the park and were throwing spears using this thing called an atlatl, which is basically a spear thrower extender. So you sort of are extending your arm with this object called an atlatl, and in order to throw the spear sort of further and with more precision. And that was my first experience of experimental archaeology. I can still remember going back to my flat in the evening, and my flatmate said, like, oh God, I've had the worst day. Like, we had a seminar on, you know, and she was a law student, which a lot of the work she was doing was fascinating, but this was a particularly dull session, apparently. She said, oh, how was your seminar, like, that you did today? And I said, well, we went to the park and we're throwing spears. And it just made me realize how much fun archaeology could be as well. You know, you could really get involved with it. But I also still remember going to my thesis advisor, and she was asking, you know, okay, so what do you want to do for your thesis? And I was going, well, I'd really love to do something with experimental archaeology, but obviously, you know, I understand that's not possible. And she was like, why isn't it possible? What do you mean? I was going, well, it's not actually a real research method, surely. Just going, of course it is. Like, of course you have to do it properly. You know, you have to set it up with proper scientific principles in mind. But of course it's a research method. It's a very valid research method. And I was going, oh my goodness. So it was incredible, that discovery that I could actually do this as a job. And it's just kind of grown from there. And so that's what I do. I am now an experimental archaeologist, which is crazy to me to think about. But so my very first research project, I wanted to look at the different ways that seaweed might have been involved in Viking metalworking techniques. And there's a whole long context, which I don't have time to get into now, but basically it involved me doing various things in a historic forge in order to see how the addition of seaweed to different forging processes affected the end result. And it was really fascinating in terms of the sort of metallurgy and the kind of insights I got from that. So, for example, I was using it as a fuel when just sort of forging and working metal. I was using it as a flux when trying to forge weld different bits of metal together. I created tar to work as sort of a coating. I'll do a link to I think you can read my thesis online. If not, feel free to send me an email and I'll send it to you. But so one of the main things that we experienced, though, was actually my now husband, then boyfriend, was with me and was helping me in this historical forge run by the amazing Dave Budd of Dave Budd Tools, who is not only a professional blacksmith, but also an experimental archaeologist. So it was perfect. And he was, my husband was in charge of working the bellows for me on this forge. And I was adding all this seaweed to the fire, and it was this billowing green smoke coming out from the seaweed. And something that's really essential to know is that in a lot of cultures, both historic and contemporary, there is this link between kind of magic and shamanism and the art of metalworking, the process of metalworking. So, for example, in Viking mythology, Viking metalworkers were sort of held in very high respect. In a lot of African cultures, the blacksmith is also a shaman. There's this kind of really strong link with this idea of the kind of change that's involved in metalworking and the importance of a person who has control of that and has that skill. So I sort of knew this from my background reading. But yeah, when we were doing this thing, first of all, this green smoke, these green flames coming out, and it really gave a sort of more ethereal quality to the whole process. But also at some point, my husband said, I'm really sorry, I need a break. And I was going, oh, you know, you're a bit tired. He's going, no, I like this smoke is just really affecting me. And another person that we were working with was saying, yeah, I didn't want to say anything, but it really smells very strongly of another kind of weed that you can get. And yes, it's absolutely true. It really stank of cannabis, which is something that I hadn't even considered. And then so we were looking into it, and I talked about my thesis supervisor with her. She was going, oh, that's fascinating. And we were talking about that a little bit more. But basically, one of the thoughts that we came up with was, okay, maybe that was why they were adding seaweed. It wasn't actually for any functional benefit. It was to kind of help them get into that trance-like state associated with the shamanistic part of metalworking rather than the practical part. So maybe that was actually its purpose. And this is something that I would never have known. I would never have experienced experiential archaeology, right? If I had been doing this experiment in like a lab with a fume hood and very controlled conditions and, you know, like that would, I would never have had that thought or that idea. So that's the first example that I had. In my master's research, I was then also looking at experimental archaeology. I was basically drilling amber beads in order to see whether you could identify what kind of material the drill bit was made out of based on the traces that drill bit leaves in the hole of a bead. So while you're drilling your bead, your drill bit will make certain traces on the inside of the hole, and you can see them with a microscope, even like 5,000 years later, which is incredible. And again, I'll put a link where you can read all of my research. Oh, actually, that's true. I'll just link in the show notes. I'll put a link to my publications page on one of my websites, so you can go and you can download all of these publications and the research that I did. And so that one as well, I was actually experiencing like the difficulties involved in the kind of practical aspect of drill making. But this also really highlighted to me how, in order to be able to drill a bead, not only did I need to know how to drill a bead, but I also needed to know where to source the amber from. I needed to know how to make and fix the tools. If my tools broke, I had to be able to fix them. I needed to collaborate with professional flintknappers. I needed to source metal materials for some of the different drill bits, which really highlighted to me the collaborative efforts that are involved in something as simple as making a bead. You know, you think that it's just, oh yeah, you make a bead. But no, there's all these different skills involved. And it's something that you really start to understand a lot more when you're actually trying to do it yourself. And then probably my most sort of famous one, which is something that I've talked about before, either on this podcast or on My Trowel, is in my PhD research, I was looking at different sewing techniques of Paleo-Inuit cultures. So these are prehistoric, pre-contact Inuit cultures living in Arctic Canada. And the needles, I was looking at the needles, and I was basically trying to see how these needles were used and what materials they were used on and all this kind of thing. And what we worked out while I was conducting a kind of collaborative workshop with modern Inuit seamstresses up in Iqaluit, which is a beautiful town in the Fox Basin of Arctic Canada. And I had taken a bunch of my replica needles with me, and we were doing sort of some experimental archaeology, some sewing, and just having fun with it. And we basically worked out that, okay, there's a very big differences in the sewing techniques used by Western researchers and the sewing techniques used by Inuk seamstresses. And again, I'll link my, oh, I can also actually link the video that I did for Exarch, I believe, on that as well. Or I think I put it online. I will find it and I will find an example of it. But yes, not only is there a difference between sort of the sewing techniques I was using and the sewing techniques that the modern Inuk ladies were using, but also that means that the difference between what they were doing and potentially what these prehistoric people were doing, because there was no comparability between the traces. And that led to a whole range of different questions, because traditionally Arctic researchers have always used historic Inuit populations as a kind of ethnographic analogy to look at past populations. So they will basically look at what historic, so sort of 1600s, 1700s, 1800s were doing in various different things. And they were assuming that these pre-contact cultures, which are a different cultural group, by the way, the Dorset cultures, they were using them to say, oh, well, if they're doing it this way, then probably the Dorset cultures, this pre-contact group, were doing it the same way. But actually, what if they were doing it a completely different way? Because that seems to have been the case with the sewing. Again, this sort of hypothesis and this brain explosion that we all had during this workshop, it was a really fascinating workshop. It only came about because we were actually practically doing it and sort of chatting about it as we were doing it. And so in that way, it really showed how it just leads to more questions and it highlights gaps in your research. And I think that's something really important about experimental archaeology as well. It sort of provides you with new questions and new directions in which to go. Again, I'll put a link in the show notes to all of this. So I realize it was a very quick overview. You can go and read all about it yourself. So that's, in my opinion, some of the strengths of Exarch. But what about some of the kind of criticisms, some of the disadvantages of experimental archaeology? Well, so processual archaeology, like I said, was sort of quite important to experimental archaeology and to sort of developing it as a method that was kind of becoming more accepted within the scientific community, although it took a while before it was really accepted. And then you had something called post-processual archaeology, which emerged in the 1980s. And again, I'll do another episode all on this. But basically, post-processual archaeology looked not just at the kind of the how, but more the why. And so they looked at the meaning of objects, at the agency of objects, at what they meant to us, at their significance. And a good example of kind of post-processual thinking is known as entanglement theory. which was proposed by Professor Ian Hodder, which basically states that kind of things, places, and people are all linked together in this kind of tangled, messy web of interactions and responsibilities and dynamics and everything. And because of this kind of entanglement, because of this web, it's impossible for us as researchers to be completely unbiased and objective. For example, while conducting experimental archaeology. And this is one of the big criticisms of experimental archaeology because, of course, we're not prehistoric people. We haven't been flintknapping our whole lives. Even people like John Evans, who, you know, became a very prolific flintknapper, he only started later in life. He wouldn't have had the same level of learning, the same level of experience as someone living in prehistory who's been doing this since, you know, potentially before they could even talk or walk. And so you're always biased as an archaeologist. And this is true in the case of every archaeological research project, right? We live in the modern world. We were brought up in the modern world. Our training, our theoretical approach, what culture we come from, our particular preferences in terms of, you know, likes and dislikes, all of this that create who we are will, however subconsciously, bias our interpretation of the world, both the present world, but also past worlds. And nothing is more clear than this than in something like experimental archaeology, where, as I was talking about, right, with my bead drilling experiments, I had to collaborate with people who were specialists in something because I did not have all of those specialist skills. I'm not a very good flintknapper. I enjoy it. I know the theory of it. Practically, I'm just not very good. Probably I haven't practiced enough. Probably I just don't have the technique. I don't have the patience, more like. But anyway, but luckily, I know a lot of people who are very, very experienced and very good at it. So I collaborate with them a lot with my experiments to source my tools. But the point being, if I were to try and create tools with flintknapping and it wouldn't work, as an experimental archaeologist, I couldn't then be like, well, obviously that didn't work. Obviously they didn't do that in the past. Because no, that's just based on my experience or lack thereof. So it's sort of, you can't escape that modern context. And that comes into play a lot when you're doing something that is so focused on things like skill and experience, like experimental archaeology. You also have this critique that, well, either they're not scientific enough because you have a lot of uncontrollable variables. So even if you try and set it out with proper scientific framework of, you know, repeatability and research question, you still will have a lot of things like researcher bias, like skill level, like material sourcing that are just not comparable with the originals. So that's one of the critiques. The other critiques is that sometimes it's too scientific. So it actually oversimplifies reality. It doesn't account for that kind of entangled web, for that messiness of life in the past. So it just can't win, really. And of course, you can rarely test all processes with experimental archaeology. And as I mentioned, just because your experiments might show that, for example, this is possible or this is not possible, that doesn't mean it's the final argument. There's always room for more experimentation with different people, with different skill sets, with different materials, with different approaches. So how can we go forward from this then? Well, experimental archaeology, I mean, I think it's a fantastic way to engage with the questions of chaîne opératoire. It's really essential as well for different branches of archaeology, such as microware analysis, which looks at these microscopic traces to show how something was made and used. In order to understand those traces, you have to create a reference collection that you can compare. And in order to create that reference collection, you have to do experimental archaeology. It's so intrinsically tied together. It's also very linked with things like ethnoarchaeology, because again, understanding the process of something, understanding how people are making things is such an important part of that. So it's really vital for a lot of different specialisms within material culture research, especially. It also, as I mentioned, it shows where there's holes in your research or it suggests new questions. So it's kind of been proposed more as a, not as the be all end all method, but as the kind of one of the methods that sort of supports or further develops your research questions and your research kind of results and discussions. What experimental archaeology is also fantastic for is outreach, because it's so hands-on, because it's so practical. It's really fantastic for things like teaching, for public engagement, for things like demonstrations of archaeology, for getting people more involved in thinking about archaeology in a different way and in thinking about material in a different way, which I also hope that you now do as well after having listened to this episode. So the next time you go to a museum or you go to a medieval festival or anything where you see some kind of either object from the past or kind of a replica from the past, trying to think not just about the final object, but trying to think of its chain operatoire, trying to think about what would have been involved in making it, what kind of decisions would that person have had to make, what was the kind of practical and social and everything context of the making of that object, why is it important, how was it tangled up with people, how did it rely on people, how did people rely on it. Hopefully it'll give you a little fun thought experiment. So I hope that you enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please, as always, do like and follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. I'll be back with more of these methodological and theoretical episodes, I think, because I really love doing them. If you'd like to learn more about the topic of today with experimental archaeology, you can find all of the links and contact information in the show notes.
Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.